This is Mark Evanier, writer on many animated series, including Thunder the Barbarian, Plastic Man, Superman the Animated Series, and The Garfield Show. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello, Nerd Nation, gathering of geeks, fanboys, and fangirls around the world. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your fellow nerd and host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Busy, busy week here at Comic Book Central. I've been lining up guests, making reservations for them here at the lair. Got some very cool episodes coming up. And if you're listening to this episode on Saturday, the day it premieres, I will more than likely be at the Steel City Con in my favorite city, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Weather permitting, of course. It's always a bit dicey this time of year in the Keystone State. Hopefully we won't have any problems traveling, but they've got a fantastic guest list for the show this year. So I'm planning to be running around as usual, recording some super content for you Comic Book Central listeners. So stay tuned in the weeks ahead for my adventures at Steel City Con. Now, while I'm doing that, you get to listen to another fun conversation here on the show. It's not often we get to hear from someone who has a foot in both worlds, comic books and comic book-themed movies and TV shows, but today we do. Get ready for my conversation with superstar writer-producer Mark Evanier. If you've ever read a comic book, and really, if you're listening to this podcast, you've read your share of comic books, you've more than likely read the words of Mark Evanier. One of Mark's earliest career moves proved to be invaluable, an assistant to the one and only Jack King Kirby. That association kickstarted a career in comic writing that saw Mark work for Disney Studios, Gold Key Comics, Eclipse Comics, and of course, Marvel and DC. But Mark's talents aren't limited to the four-color paneled pages of our favorite funny books. Mark is an accomplished television writer and producer. Going back to the days where he penned jokes and insults for Mr. Cotter and the Sweat Hogs on Welcome Back, Cotter.
Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out.
Hour upon hour of episodic animated shows followed, including Scooby-Doo, Plastic Man, Thundar the Barbarian, Richie Rich, Superman the Animated Series, that's just to name a few. Mark is currently the supervising producer and voice director for that sarcastic, lasagna-loving feline, Garfield, on The Garfield Show. Well, my guest today has a foot planted firmly in each world, comic book writing and comic book-themed television writing. He's put Plastic Man, Thundar, Indiana Jones, and even the Sweat Hogs through their paces. He's currently the writer, producer, and voice director for The Garfield Show. He's Mark Evanier. Mark, welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here.
Is it true you first became interested in writing because you saw how much fun the writers were having on the Dick Van Dyke Show?
Well, I started writing even before that. I was a writer when I was like 6 years old. I was taking the construction paper they gave us to draw on in kindergarten. I was writing books that were plagiarism of Dr. Seuss. and that was good because people have made a very good living plagiarizing Dr. Seuss over the years.
Yes, they have. You weren't doing the cutting and pasting and sniffing the glue and all that, eating on the construction paper.
I took the crayons and I wrote and drew imitation Dr. Seuss books, and the teachers thought this was so astounding that I was working way above my level of linguistic skills that they started skipping me in grades and advancing me and treating me like this was very special. And I went, oh, well, I think I'll keep writing. You get treated well when you're a writer. Little did I know. Wow. But when I got to see the Dick Van Dyke Show, that became a very important moment in my life because I didn't know before that what I wanted to be a writer of. I wanted to write comic books. I wanted to write cartoon shows. I wanted to write TV shows. I wanted to write novels. But when I went to see the Dick Van Dyke Show being filmed, actually I was a fan of the show from just watching it on TV, but I went to see an episode filmed one time And boy, that just changed my life that day because Dick Van Dyke was so cool and funny, and Mary Tyler Moore was so gorgeous, and she was in color when I went to see her, actually.
Even better.
I saw the writers hanging around. You know, I knew I was not going to be a performer even then, but the writers were hanging around. They were part of that world, and they were making contributions. I saw them in action. I thought, hey, maybe I could do that. And, you know, something about like 10 years later, I was doing that for a living, and I'm still kind of amazed about that.
How old were you when you saw the Dick Van Dyke Show in person? So you're in the audience. How old of a kid
are you? I was 12, 11, something like that. You were supposed to be 16 to get in to see the filming, but I ran into my family. I ran into Maury Amsterdam, who was on the show. We ran into him at the airport, and he invited us to be a filming as his guests. So the age limit was waived, and we got these wonderful seats. And he was supposed to, he promised if we went to this, he would introduce me to Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore and the whole cast. And it turns out the episode we went to, he wasn't there that night. So it was years later that I got years later I got to meet Dick Van Dyke and Rose Marie and Mary Tyler Moore in other contexts and such. But it still was just a life-changing experience. It seemed like a very happy environment to work in, and it was. I later worked on some TV shows that were not happy environments, but the Dick Van Dyke Show was just, it's the people that were so interesting. You wanted to hang out with them. I mean, who wouldn't want to hang out with Buddy and Sally and, you know, trip over footstools and go home to Mary Tyler Moore. You know, that was just a very enriching experience to kind of bond with your childhood idols and that entity and such. And the same thing happens when I find myself writing a comic book about a cartoon about a character that I grew up with, or working with some of the voice actors who did the cartoons that I watched when I was a kid. It's hard for me to believe that I'm writing something that June Foray is going to read, or that you know, I'm writing a comic book that's going to be drawn by a guy whose comics I read when I was 9.
Well, let's talk about some of those. What were some of those early influences? Some of the TV shows you watched? Some of the comic books you read?
Yeah, my influences were hardly unique to me. Hardly unique to me. I was influenced by Mad Magazine. I was influenced by all the comic books I read early on, the Disney comics, the Warner Brothers comics, DC and Marvel, and all those. I was influenced by the TV shows I watched, the Huckleberry Hound show and the Rocky and his friends, the Jay Ward cartoons. I was influenced a lot by Soupy Sales and by a lot of comedians on records, particularly Stan Freberg. I don't know how familiar all your listeners are with Stan Freberg. He was the master satirist of comedy records in the 50s. And
we probably know him as the voice of Pete Puma, right?
He was the voice of Pete Puma. He's the voice of a lot of characters in Warner Brothers cartoons. Yeah. He also more or less perfected the idea of funny advertising. In the 60s and 70s, anytime you saw a really funny commercial on TV, it was either produced by Stan Freberg or it was produced by an advertising agency that had been asked to do a Stan Freberg-style commercial. Mm. And he was just witty and very clever, and he became a real hero of mine. And I got to work with him and know him, and he has done voices on some of my cartoon shows, on the Garfield show and others. And just a couple weeks ago, we did a tribute. I produced co-produced a tribute to him. We had a big tribute at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. We had all these celebrities there, and Stan and his wife were there, and we showed clips of his work. He's 88 years old now, and we figured it was time for a tribute to honor this man.
Oh, yeah, of course. And you got to work with him on Garfield, too, right?
Yeah. He would watch the cartoon. It was funny. Garfield was on the old Garfield, the original one, Garfield and Friends, was on so early that I didn't get up and watch it usually when it was on, and I'd already seen them. So I'd get up, and my answering machine, there'd be a message from Stan. He'd watch the cartoon he was on, and he'd leave this message. I've still got a few of them. He'd say, like in his Freebergian voice, he'd say, protégé, this is your idol speaking. And he would very intentionally doing a character, real snotty, withering character, he would critique the cartoon and say, oh, I see you got a little influence from me on that joke there. And he critiqued the whole half hour, not just the cartoon he was in, or the whole hour. And it was just very amazing that, it's very strange. You know, I worked for a long time with a man named Dawes Butler, who was the voice of Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear and Quick Draw and all those people. And I loved Dawes. Personally, I loved his characters. I loved his voice. And every so often, the phone would ring, and I'd pick it up, and it would be Yogi Bear. he would call me, and he'd lapse into one of his voices, and you know, and I'd say to, and I would, you know, say to someone, I was in a call waiting, he'd interrupt. I'd say to someone, "Excuse me, I've got Yogi Bear on the other line. I've got to talk to him." and they go, "Yeah, sure." And it was Yogi Bear. He was, oh, you know, wow, calling from Jellystone. It's so, wow, unusual to, you can see an arc in your life sometimes where you go from being a fan of someone to being a peer. When I was about 8 or 9, one of the first movies I ever saw that I was cognizant of was a Jerry Lewis movie called Don't Give Up the Ship. And that comic book of it, the Dell comic book adaptation, was drawn by a man named Dan Spiegel, who I later was teamed with on the Black Hawk comic and Crossfire. We did dozens of comic books. We did the Scooby-Doo comic book together. One of my favorite collaborators, one of the nicest men I know, became a very close friend. And I can just remember reading this man's comic books and reading he used to draw the Maverick comic books, and he drew Space Family Robinson and lots of adaptations and things. And all of a sudden, I'm now, instead of reading comic books drawn by Dan Spiegel, I'm writing comic books be drawn by Dan Spiegel.
Amazing. How did you make that transition to get, like, okay, so I want to be a writer. I love all that thing I'm seeing. How does that 12-year-old boy become a comic book writer?
Well, I knew way before I was 12 that I wanted to be a writer. That was the only thing I had. The way I usually phrase it is this: that was the thing in this world I was least lousy at. I mean, I could use up the rest of this podcast telling you things I could not do, the skills I do not have. It was writing or nothing as far as I was concerned. So I wrote a lot of stuff in high school. I wrote for school papers. I wrote for fanzines. We used to have these fanzines, mimeographed things. I wrote for little articles wherever I could for free. And then when I got out of high school in 1969, I wrote up some articles for local magazines, things published in Los Angeles, and I submitted them, and they started buying them. And shortly after that, I met a man you may have heard of named Jack Kirby. And
yeah, you see this on your bio, and it's like, yeah, those words, apprenticed by Jack Kirby, and you're like, yeah, whoa.
and whoa. I was actually a professional writer before I met Jack, but he recommended me for a couple of jobs, and I had actually, the funny thing was that of all the things I was thinking I wanted to write when I was growing up, the one I thought I had the least chance of doing was comic books, because most comic books were edited out of New York. And I was living in Los Angeles, and all the interviews I read with people working in comics, publishers and editors and writers, said, "Oh, you got to live in New York." Now, as it turned out, you didn't, because Gold Key Comics, they were once Dell, then they became Gold Key Comics. They were based in Los Angeles, and I worked for them for years. But somehow that didn't dawn on me at the time. I didn't think about that. I thought, well, I can't really do comics because I don't want to move to New York to work for DC or Marvel. I want to live in Los Angeles. So I kind of wrote them off, and which was okay. I couldn't achieve all my fantasies, but then a couple of the editors at DC and at Charlton asked me to write scripts for them, and I submitted stuff, and each time the editor accepted the work, said, "Oh, we'll buy this," and then didn't. Usually the editor would accept it and then get fired. This actually happened 3 times to me, and I thought, well, I don't, you know, gee, even if they want to buy my work, they're not buying my work. So I will not work for DC or Marvel. Mm. And then all of a sudden, there's Jack Kirby in Southern California, and you know, if they could work with Jack Kirby in Southern California, they could work with me.
Yeah.
So Jack helped. I did some work for Jack, and I started writing, one of my friends who I already knew was a fellow named Mike Royer, who became Jack's inker for a while. He lettered and inked New Gods and Forever People, Mr. Miracle, and all those books. And Mike recommended me for a job at Disney writing comic books for the Disney studio. And I got that, and that segued to writing the American comics. The ones for Disney were foreign comics for overseas. And 2.5 years after I got out of high school, I had all the comic book work I could possibly handle. I was turning down stuff. The editors at Gold Key just said, "We'll take anything you write." And so I was writing like 8 comic books a month or something like that. I was writing.
Wow. It was a lot Bugs of adaptations, and, Gold Key, right?
Well, I was doing Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig and Daffy Duck and the Roadrunner and Super Goof and Woody Woodpecker and Scooby Doo and the Pink Panther and a dozen others.
All the characters you grew up with.
Not every issue. Well, yeah, not every issue of those. I wrote stories for all those books, but I was writing about. I mean, I was writing for 8 different comics. I was writing maybe 4 comic books a month.
Wow.
And, you know, that's pretty good to do. And I segued from that to writing the Tarzan comic books for overseas for a while. And then I segued from that to writing television.
Well, what did once you were apprenticing with Jack Kirby, I mean, what did you learn from the King? How did he influence your work?
Well, I'll tell you, there's an awful lot of things I learned from Jack, not necessarily all about comic books or about writing. I learned about being a human being, and because Jack was an amazing human being, and he had this mind that just grabbed onto everything. People thought he had a wandering mind, and he did, because he was always thinking of 12 things at once. And when you talk to Jack, sometimes it was a little disconcerting, because he would leave things out. He would start talking to you about something and he'd just skip over like reading a book, a great book, but someone's skipping over paragraphs, and you'd have to go back to figure out what he said and fill in. And then when you did, you understood that it was just an amazing insight into the world or to politics or to people. Or, you know, the thing I tell people the most I learned from Jack, and there's quite a few, Jack, if you look back, Jack, everyone used to say Jack was the fastest artist in comics. And he was very, very fast. One of the reasons that Jack produced so much material in his lifetime was not just that he was fast. He was a very fast writer, a very fast artist. He would draw, twice as fast as anybody else and put 3 times as much drawing into the pages. But one of the reasons he did so much was that he was a very hard worker. He would sit at that drawing table for 10, 12, 14 hours with only minor breaks. He would start work on a day around noon, and he would work till around 4 or 5 in the morning and stop for half an hour to watch a TV show or half an hour to eat with his family. But 7 days a week, he would put in that incredible effort, and he enjoyed it. It was good, honest work to him, and he loved the fact that that was how he was feeding his family and buying groceries, was through this just superhuman effort.
Wow.
Well, I looked at Jack, and I thought to myself, I'm never going to be as brilliant as that guy. I'm never going to have as many. I certainly can't draw as well as he can. I can't come up with so many brilliant ideas. But it is possible to work that hard. I could do that part of it. I could work the same amount of hours. That I could do. And to be that dedicated to the work. And Jack was very, very dedicated to the work. Even when he believed he was going to get swindled on what he was doing, which he did often, and even if he thought the work was going to be despoiled by those who inked and colored it or whatever, or printed it, which it happened often, he still put in 110% on everything.
You mentioned television writing, getting into television writing. How did you make the transition from comic books to television?
There's a couple little routes, but basically, at the time I was doing it, comedy writers came in pairs. For some reason, people were oriented towards hiring teams. I met a fellow named Dennis Palumbo, who was newly immigrated from Pittsburgh to Los Angeles. He was trying to become a TV writer. He needed a partner. He proposed that I be his partner. I said, hey, okay, fine. And Dennis was very good at something that I was kind of deficient in, that I'm still not very good at, and that was pitching and selling. He was a very good writer, too, but he was also skilled at doing something I could not do, which was to call somebody up and say, hey, I hear you're looking for writers. My partner and I are available. We've got some ideas we'd like to bring you. I couldn't do that. I still can't do that, really. But Dennis was good at it, and he got us some meetings, and that got us some script sales, and we sold scripts, and we wrote a bunch of different TV shows. And by the time we decided to go our separate ways, we remained friends, but we had... By the time we decided to go our separate ways, I was in the business, I had an agent, I had some track record, and I kept writing TV shows after that. So I got to the point kind of in my life where I was spending a third of my time writing comic books, a third of my time writing live-action TV shows, and a third of my time writing animation. and
all of our favorite things here at Comic Book Central. So you hit the trifecta.
Well, the event, first of all, you know, you get something out of each one. There are things you get from each of those things that you don't, each one of those things you don't get from the other two. And also, I never felt trapped in any one of them. And if at one point in my life, you know, the comic book people weren't treating me very well, I could think, well, I don't need this. I've got the other stuff. And one of the things I learned is never paint yourself into a corner doing one thing. I've never done one thing my entire life. Because, first of all, I learned if you do enough different things, you don't have to do any of them well. People think you're versatile. But also, when you do a lot of different things, you bring something from one to another, and when I get bored writing one thing, I can write something else. And when you work for people, if they know that you have something else to do, they treat you better.
What are the differences to you between comic book writing and television script writing?
Lots of money differences. Television pays a lot better.
Other than the financial gain.
No, I'll tell you, the main difference, seriously, is that when I write a comic book, between me and the audience are about five people. You know, there's an artist, maybe an inker, a letterer, a colorist, maybe an editor. Usually, I haven't had a lot of editors in some of the comic books I've done. And what gets to the consumer, what gets to the reader, is usually pretty much what I had in mind. Whether it's good or not, I can look at that and go, oh, yeah, there's my joke. I did that. Oh, I didn't do that well. I feel a connection to the work. When I do TV shows, sometimes, you know, by the time you get through with the directors, the actors, and the network, and the producers, and the art directors, and, you know, you look at some, I've looked at written TV shows, I look at them and go, yeah, oh, wait a minute, there's my joke there, and oh, well, that wasn't the way I wanted to do that. There's a certain sense of being in charge as the writer on a comic book that I don't get on most TV jobs. Years ago, I did a cartoon show that no one listening to this will remember, called Rickety Rocket. It was a short-lived show. It was so far behind in schedule, and they did it. They came to me and they said, can you write 5 half-hours in a week? And I wrote 5 half-hours
in a week. Wow. Are you kidding me?
Dashing them off. Oh. And the shows aired, and they didn't have credits on them back then. They didn't have credits on individual episodes. And I didn't see them. Didn't have copies of them. And then a few years ago, Boomerang ran them, and I recorded all the episodes and sat down and tried to figure out which ones I'd written. And I was having trouble doing it. I would start watching an episode and go, well, that sounds like me. Oh, I wouldn't do that. Because each one of them had been rewritten a little bit by other people. So finding one or two lines that were definitely not me didn't mean I hadn't written the episode. And I knew I'd written five of them, and I literally had to figure out which five were mine. Mm. I think I did.
There's just so many hands that it has to go through by the time it hits air. Yeah.
But you feel so distanced from it.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like being a spectator. And I don't feel that way with comic books. I don't feel that way with an issue of Gru. It's, you know, it's Sergio and me and Stan Sakai and Tom Luth, and that's it, really.
Well, there's probably an intimacy with the comic book, too. You hold it. It's there in your hand. I mean, it's self-contained. Yeah. It's not this thing that's out over the airwaves.
And also, generally speaking, and there are exceptions to this, comic books are easier to do in terms of, like, I've done TV shows where I spend 20% of my time writing and 80% of my time in meetings and defending the work and arguing for it and watching rehearsals and giving notes and comments and fighting with the network. And when I do comic books, generally speaking, I spend 100% of my time or 90% of my time being the writer of it. I would much rather be a writer than a guy who argues about, you know, jokes on page 9 or you know, there's things you get out of each one of these things. And on the other hand, you know, when I wrote TV shows, I got to work with Sid Caesar and Jerry Lewis and you know, wonderful performers and people I loved over the years. And I got to write songs, and I got to hear an audience actually laughing sometimes at what I wrote. So you get some different things. And writing the cartoons are kind of fun. I wrote a Yogi Bear special one time, and you know, here I'm sitting in meetings with Joe Barbera discussing Yogi Bear jokes, and I thought, I grew up on Yogi Bear. I grew up on the work of Joe Barbera. And it's very, I hope it doesn't sound conceited or anything like that, because it's I'm in awe of this. I'm just this poor schmuck who got to do this stuff, and you know, and I share the joy of, try to share the joy of it with others. My father hated his job. My father had one of the worst jobs in the world. He worked for the Internal Revenue Service, came home every day hating the job, getting an ulcer, and he felt trapped in it because he couldn't do anything else. And he said to me, "Mark, do whatever you want with your life as long as A, you can make a living at it, and B, you love it." And he was very proud that I did that. And I you know, urge people to understand that you have to find something in this world that you love to do and can make a living doing. And, you know, that's the, you know, if people take nothing away from listening to these podcasts I do every so often, they should, you know, get that as a message.
Yeah, it's amazing that you get to have a hand in all these things. We mentioned earlier at the top of the show, one of those early television jobs, it may have been your first, I'm not sure. Is it Welcome Back, Kotter? Was that one of your first writing gigs?
Was one of my first, yeah, one of my first TV jobs, yeah. And I was not a fan of that show. I never saw the show before I was hired, actually. And I never watched it after I left the show.
How far into the show's run did you come in?
I was on the second season. I was on the second season.
So it was already a juggernaut at this point. I mean, it's all Sweat Hogs and Barbarino and John Travolta.
Yeah, it was already a hit, and the show was undergoing enormous problems. It was a very ugly environment in certain ways because people were fighting a lot. It was, you know, kind of a cross between a situation comedy and a baton death march each week to you know, and there were a lot of fights and people not speaking to each other and arguing but it was still a half hour of network television every week, and there were some very joyous moments in it. I just enjoyed doing it. Yeah,
I think it's one of those things where it's Gabe Kaplan's show. But then the Sweat Hogs kind of just overtook everything. It just was that.
Well, the problem on that particular show was that the man named Jimmy Comack was the executive producer, and he didn't quite own this show, but he was in the role of the owner. And then you had Gabe Kaplan, and the two of them hated each other.
Mm.
They didn't agree on how the show should be done. They didn't agree on it. Gabe had no problem with the Sweat Hogs stealing the show because he knew that, you know, he would look good if the show was a success. One of the things that you have to understand in television sometimes is it isn't always about you. There's an example we give to a lot of stars. Every time I did a TV show that had a new star in it, we would give them what we called the Jack Benny speech, which was how Jack Benny did not get the laughs on his show. If you watch the Jack Benny programs for years, he wasn't the one who got the laugh.
No, he's a straight
Don
man.
Wilson got the laugh, or Dennis Day got the laugh, or Mel Blanc got the laugh, or Mary Livingston got the laugh, or especially Rochester got the laugh, and Jack didn't. And then you look at something like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where Ted Knight got the laugh, and Ed Asner got the laugh, and Gavin McLeod got the laugh, but not Mary. Or your best example is the Andy Griffith Show, where Andy just basically handed the whole show over to Don Knotts.
Yeah.
Well, nobody in the history of television as a star ever had a better career than Jack Benny, Mary Tyler Moore, and Andy Griffith. It sure didn't hurt them to let the show be good with other people excelling on it. And, you know, you meet people today, I've worked with some people who just don't quite get that. They think their name is in the title of the show. They have to get all the laughs. They have to get all the attention. And it doesn't work sometimes.
What's interesting about Welcome Back, Kotter, too, is I think, because we talk about how you have a foot in both worlds, you got to write the comic book, too. DC Comics had the adaptation, because they had, and then they had the Treasury edition, too.
Yeah, I wrote two issues of the comic book, and the second one wound up being a Treasury edition.
Yeah.
I wrote two scripts. I was very busy at the time. I was too busy to do, Kotter was a night and day job. It was just night and day and 7 days a week, and get up in the morning and go to the studio and stay there till 4 in the morning, or go up to Gabe Kaplan's house and rewrite the script till 4 in the morning, and then go home, fall into bed, get up the next morning. It was just a completely life-consuming experience, which is one of the reasons. There were things I enjoyed there, but that wasn't it. And I wrote 2 issues of the comic book, and actually I did it because they asked me, and I thought, well, it'd be fun to write these characters without arguing with the actors. I thought it'd be refreshing to just write a Cotter story. I didn't have to worry about the network or the actors or the director or the lighting guy or anything like that having an opinion. Well, it turned out the comic book was harder than the TV show because the editor of it somehow could not grasp the fact that I was writing the TV show. I mean, he knew it, but he didn't know it. He thought he knew more about these characters than I did. And we actually had the story that I tell was we had this episode, we had this joke in one of the issues I did. We had the character Arnold Horshack.
Is this the Tyrannosaurus Rex with the gym teacher?
Yeah, it was in that one. That's right. And I had some character who was just going on and talking like crazy. And at the time, there was a man named Evel Knievel who was in the news because he was promising to jump his motorcycle over the Grand Canyon. And he ended up jumping it over another canyon because they wouldn't let him jump the Grand Canyon.
The Snake River.
So I had Arnold Horshack say to this character, because these characters are always insulting each other. I said, hey, he says, hey, Evel Knievel just called. He wants to know if he can jump your mouth. So the editor of the comic book left this message on my answering machine saying, I got to talk to you. There's a couple of changes we have to make in the script. So I called him up, and I called him from the studio. They had this thing called the Watts line. It's an old antiquated thing we had in the 70s where you could call anywhere for long distance for free. And I called him back from the watch line. So I'm sitting like in the studio, in the waiting room, outside the rehearsal hall. And he cites that joke, and he says, Arnold Horshack would never say that. I know this character real well. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm the story editor of the show. Why are you telling me you know the character better than I do? and he'd say, no, that's so unlike Arnold. He's not that kind of character. And I said, yes, he is. He is like that character. He says, oh, no, Arnold would never say that. And just then, I'm swearing it's true, this is true, Ron Palillo, who played Horshack on the show, is walking through the weight room. And I put the editor on a hold. I said, excuse me. And I said, Ron, let's imagine a situation where Horshack is dealing with a person with a loud mouth. He turns to the person and says, hey, Evel Knievel just called. He wants to know if he can jump your mouth. And Ron goes, oh, that's perfect. God, can we use that? That's funny. Oh, can we put that in the script this week? And I said, okay, well, we'll stick it in someplace. I went back on the phone to the editor and said, okay, I'll cut it out. You're right. It doesn't fit. And Arnold not only said that line in the show that week, it was in the promos. It's the line ABC pulled out to put in all the promos that ran on all the other shows.
Nice.
They stuck that joke in. And I always wonder if the editor ever saw the show or
saw the promo.
He never
told you about it, that's for sure.
He never mentioned it, but I thought, well, that's so...
Oh, that's great. Well, and the thing is, that you can only say up your nose with a rubber hose so many different times. It's like, you know what? When the actors get
on that show,
a
we
piece
couldn't
of,
say
you know, golden line, yeah, take it.
On that show, we couldn't say it enough. the problem with that show was we had 25 minutes. When you take out all the commercials out of a half hour, we had 25 minutes. And if John Travolta came out, walked in and wiggled his hips, the audience screamed for 30 seconds. And if Ron Palillo as Horshack went, ooh, 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 the audience screamed for 45 seconds. And if Bobby Hedges as Epstein said, hey, I got a note from my mom, the audience laughed for 20 minutes on that, whatever it was. And we had trouble getting a script into the 25 minutes. After everybody had done their catchphrase, there wasn't that much time left. And we had
and
to keep
live audience.
Cramming
in.
Yeah, the audiences were very hot then,
yeah,
which made it very interesting, a very interesting challenge to try to turn that little juggernaut that was Cotter in a different story every week, and sometimes obviously we did not succeed, but it was a fascinating challenge, and it was kind of guerrilla writing, because you write something and a few hours later sometimes the audience is laughing or not at it.
Was it around this time that you started your professional relationship, professional partnership with Steve Gerber?
Yeah, a little later, a bit later than that. I was after Cotter. I met Steve
because you did a Howard the Duck with him, right? You wrote an
issue
of Howard the Duck.
Yeah, I did. Well, I did a fill. Well, I helped with an issue.
Okay.
Steve was out here, had moved out here. I think he moved out here a year or two after I did Cotter. I was working for Sid and Marty Krofft mostly at the time, and for Hanna-Barbera. And I helped Steve get some work at Ruby Spears in an animation studio on the Plastic Man show, because Steve was having trouble getting work out of Marvel, and they had they kept firing or not firing. It was very, and he was, and so I got him into animation writing, and he did Plastic Man, and he did Thunder the Barbarian with me, and a few other shows.
You mentioned a couple of these. Let's talk about some of these. First, Plastic Man. What was your experience like working with Plastic Man? This character was that one of your favorite characters?
I loved Plastic Man in the comic books. The TV show was not like the comic books. That was for Ruby Spears and a man named Norman Maurer, who had once been Joe Kubert's partner and a comic book artist. He had come up with this new version of Plastic Man that had him as a spy working for this strange lady in an agency, and he had a sidekick who was Hawaiian. It was you know, the basic Jack Cole character put in an entirely different context, which I wasn't wild about, but that was the assignment. And I had done a few jobs for Ruby Spears beforehand. I'd written some of the ABC Weekend specials, and they asked me to write some Plastic Man, so I said, sure. And I wrote 6 or 7 episodes of it, and I didn't think of it as, you know, I didn't think of it as the Plastic Man. I thought of it as a Plastic Man. It was a good character, and they had a good guy, Michael Bell, doing the voice, so I loved Michael's, just, you know, he was a good actor for that role. He was very good for it. And I was new at writing those kind of shows, so it was good training, and it was fun, and I wouldn't compare it to the Plastic Man Jack Cole did, but it was a decent show.
What are some of the limitations you found in writing for a kids' television show, Saturday morning TV, as opposed to some of the comic books?
Well, back then they were very formidable. They're nowhere near that anymore. And at ABC they were worse. At ABC there was a lady there who I think is still at ABC who I fought with for years of my life. Every time I wrote a script, she wanted to cut the guts of it out, and I had to fight them. I had to defend them. And at one point in my life, this is very strange, I was story editing the Richie Rich cartoon show for Hanna-Barbera, and I was simultaneously a writer on the primetime show That's Incredible. I was doing both shows at the same time. There were two. I had like 4 full-time jobs at the same time, and those were 2 of them. And we had
you
the same.
Bring my whole childhood back to me while you're saying these shows.
We had the same standards and practices, lady. So I'd go up to her on the set of...
The same one on Richie Rich that was on...
Yes, same one was on That's Incredible.
That's Incredible?
So I would go up to her on That's Incredible, and I would argue with her about Richie Rich. And what you do with these people, frequently, is you make trades. I'll cut this joke if you leave this in. I'll cut this if you leave this in. Some of us would put in things we didn't want to leave in just so we'd have something to trade off and cut out. So I would actually trade a Richie Rich joke for a That's Incredible line. She'd say... You can't put that joke in Richie Rich. And I say, how about this? If you leave it in, I'll cut this other thing out of That's Incredible you want. She'd say, okay. So I was sacrificing one for the other.
Let's make a deal.
Yeah. But they had a lot of very stringent rules, and they changed from time to time. A lot of them were about imitatable behavior. They had this premise that if I did a cartoon show where I dropped a piano on someone's head, that kids would go out and drop pianos on each other's heads. And they weren't completely wrong about this, because there actually were a couple of cases, not with pianos, but where kids did imitate what was on they saw on cartoon shows and did something, mostly like sticking your finger in a light socket. So that's always been a no on cartoon shows. Don't stick your finger in a light socket, because kids have done that.
Yeah.
But nobody ever dropped a piano on it. And then they would take it to so many weird extremes. I had a friend who wrote a script where, to save the day, it called for the hero to cut a rope. If he just cut this rope in time, he would save the day. And in his script, he had the guy pull out a pocket knife and cut the rope. And they said, no, you can't. The hero can't carry a knife. And we said, I even got into this. But Boy Scouts carry knives. Don't we want kids to be boys? No, you can't have a knife. And that was how about he gets a pair of scissors? Well, gee, scissors. He's running. He's running with scissors. It just became, they had carried it way too far.
Yeah.
And there were also people who did not like the trend to adventure shows at all. I produced in about 1982 or 83 a special, primetime special for ABC, on the history of children's television, ABC. It was one of those preview specials for Saturday morning, and Dick Clark was the host of it. and we were showing clips from the great past kids shows on ABC along with previewing the new ones. So we had clips of Beanie and Cecil, and we had clips of Soupy Sales, we had clips of all these great kids shows of the past that run on ABC. And the lady, the same standards of practices lady, the same one as I dealt with on Richie Rich, and That's Incredible, it demanded that I leave Johnny Quest out. Because she said, that's the show that ruined Saturday morning. Johnny Quest, that was the first real adventure show on Saturday morning. And she hated that show, and she wished it had never existed and wanted to stamp out that trend. And I said, it was on ABC, you're talking about revising history. I essentially accused her of lying. I said, you want us to put a lie in and say Johnny Quest wasn't on the air? Well, it was on the air, and we're putting this in. And it's every so often you have to go to the mat with them and say, I'm not gonna follow that. You can reject the whole show and not air anything if you want to. And they back down usually on those. The trick is to not do that too often.
Pick your battles.
Yeah.
Well, thank goodness they left the sword in for Thundar the Barbarian. Is that what
because it was a light sword.
Right.
That's how they got away with it.
If it had been a regular sword, no way?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was one of the things that Gerber came up with that. He thought, we can get away with a light sword.
Yeah, these are a lot of different elements we talked about coming together. We've got Steve Gerber creating Thundar the Barbarian. Jack Kirby production design?
What happened with Jack, people don't understand this. Thundar was originally developed. Gerber was the guy who did the development on it. And they brought Alex Toth in to do the designs of the characters.
This is Space Ghosts, Alex Toth?
Alex Toth, who did Space Ghost and who designed a lot of the Hanna-Barbera shows and Herculoids. He's one of the greatest comic book artists who ever lived. And Alex designed the three key characters in Thundar. And, Ruby Spears, the studio, sent those over to the network. This is what we want the characters to look like. And then they said, well, let's see more of this world. We're intrigued by this. What does his world look like? Let's see some artwork of the monsters he meets, the villains he meets. Let's see some shots of the character in action. Well, Alex wasn't available at that moment. So Joe Ruby at the studio said, we got to get somebody else to draw this. And I knew Jack Kirby was looking for work outside of comic books because at that moment in his life, Jack was not happy with the way Marvel was treating him. He didn't want to go back to DC. He was looking for something new to do. So I recommended Jack, and he was hired to come in, and he did he did all the presentation art after Alex. He took Alex's designs, and then Jack basically Alex designed the three lead characters, and then Jack designed everything else. And he designed the world, and he designed vehicles and monsters, and he did sketches of the environment, so you'd see how Thundar's world looked, and then the animators of the show would adapt his designs and use them in animation. It was a very effective team. It was a very effective use of Jack's design skills because, nobody was ever better at inventing what characters look like than Jack Kirby.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about all the legendary talents, yourself included, working on this show. I mean, just the look of it is amazing. What was your experience like working on that show? Did you have fun?
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was a fun show. I enjoyed it. Gerber was the lead guy there. I was basically working for him, but he was a staff guy, and I don't like being a staff guy. I like being freelance.
Well, you have to answer to those guys. You hate having those meetings. Always talking
about. I like staying home and writing. I don't like going to an office and having to comb my hair and shave every day and
put on pants.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, pants. And I'm actually dressed at the moment, but I could have done this interview in my underwear.
It's fine. We're relaxed here at the Lair. Was one of the ones you had to show up for the Superboy TV series first episode?
No,
season
not at all.
One.
No. I just wrote a script for that and handed it in.
I'm looking at some of these things, and they're great episodes, but there's also another level to them. This one, it was in season one, The Invisible People, was directed by Jackie Cooper.
Yeah.
Did you get to meet Jackie?
No, oddly enough, what happened with that? I was very divorced from that show.
Of course, he played Perry White in the Superman movie series with Christopher Reeve.
What happened was that the Writers Guild was on strike, and a few shows had signed interim agreements that they could work during the strike. They'd signed deals with the Writers Guild that allowed them to keep in production during the strike. The Writers Guild is on strike every 20 minutes. I got this call out of the blue from the people doing the Superboy show saying, well, we really want you to write some episodes of this thing. And I was, you know, and I think it was That's Incredible. I may be off on the chronology. I wasn't working on That's Incredible at the moment because we were on strike. But Superboy was hiring. So I thought, oh, okay. So I went in, I met the people, and at that point, the show had not been cast. At that point, they hadn't started filming anything, and I think they had a very inflated idea of what they could do in terms of budgets and special effects. And they had me write a script that I think probably when they got it done, I did it to their specifications, and I have a feeling, I wasn't around for this, that when they got the script finally into production, somebody came in and said, this show is, you know, will cost us $4 million to shoot. Cut it down to $200,000 or whatever it was, because it was full of elaborate special effects that they asked for. And so they did a lot of editing, rewriting on it.
Yeah, a lot of the episode takes place on the beach.
Yeah, yeah, they cut it way down. They had me write a chase scene that went all through town, and Superboy flying down streets and turning corners and lifting up cars. And I thought to myself, "Do you want this?" And they said, "Yeah, we're doing this. We're gonna do all this stuff." That's what. And I went, "Okay, fine." And I wrote the script, and they said, "Great, terrific. We want you to do another one." And then the strike ended, and I had to go back on That's Incredible. And we had to produce like 5 episodes in 2 weeks or something. So I didn't have time to do any more Superboys.
What was the basis for your episode? It was about this beach club owner played by Enos from Dukes of Hazzard, of all things.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with the casting. Yeah. Jackie Cooper was hired after I was gone. I don't think they even cast Superboy at that point.
Mm. Well, like Enos is like trying to get rid of all these homeless people off the beach.
Yeah.
So what was your inspiration for writing the episode?
They had said to me, we want each episode to have a little social message. That was the thought at the time. Mm. And I thought it was interesting that, I walked in and I said, here's the scene. A homeless person says, I have a superpower that even Superboy doesn't have. I can turn invisible. He goes, what? Watch this. And the homeless person walks up to somebody who's walking by and says, excuse me, sir, could you spare something, some change I haven't eaten? And the person walks right past him like he doesn't see him, which is what 80% of the people do with homeless people. And the homeless person turns back to Lionel Lang or whoever she was talking to and says, see, and I'm invisible. They don't see me. And the story editors or the producers who went, oh, that's great. That's exactly what we want to do. And I mean, I just had this idea that I thought the message, to the extent there was a message, was, hey, homeless people are there. You can't pretend they aren't there to deal with them. You know, there's lots of different things you can do for them or not do for them, there's different ways. I wasn't even going to talk about that. All I wanted to do in the episode was say, hey, these are human beings, and they deserve to be recognized that they've got a problem. Don't pretend they aren't there. And that was all I was trying to sell in the premise. And they liked that, and I went off and wrote the script, and they brought it in, and they said, make the chase scenes longer. Some more elaborate. You don't have enough special effects and stuff. And I went back and went, okay.
And they all got cut out, yeah.
And then they all got cut out, and the script got heavily rewritten. It was way over length when I wrote to the length they asked for. And I did not see that episode for when it aired because it was preempted in Los Angeles. It aired on election night, and it didn't run in Los Angeles. I didn't see it until it came out on home video years later.
Well, it's on DVD. Yeah, we've got it on DVD now. We can watch
it. Yeah, and I looked at it. I looked at the episode, and I didn't recognize. I mean, I hadn't seen. It had been, 15 years since I wrote it, or 12 years since I wrote it, or whatever. And I don't. I went, gee, I don't remember these any lines of mine. This. And I went back that up the script. I don't know how to use some of my lines, but that's why I said earlier. You feel distance sometimes from the product. I didn't feel possessive about Superboy. It was just, you get a job, you do the best you can, and then it becomes somebody else's show to story edit and edit and produce and rewrite and reinterpret. I'm sure Jackie Cooper changed something I did.
Oh, Perry
that's
White.
Okay. That's, yeah, that's
Great
that's
Caesar's
the,
Ghost.
Yeah, you know, he's entitled to. He's Jackie Cooper, for God's sake. You know,
exactly.
He was a major figure in television and in motion picture history.
Yeah.
So, you know, no, it's like the difference. It's sometimes it's like the difference between, you know, being a football player and being a tennis star. The tennis star succeeds or falls on his or her own skill, and the football player is part of a team. You can be on a winning team in football and not do anything.
Yeah.
Or you could be on a winning team in football and you just blocked once.
You could be a kicker.
Yeah, or whatever it is. I mean, it's just different things. You know, if you're playing baseball, you know, you get the same World Series ring if your team wins, even though they didn't hit the ball to you.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can be a team player or you can be an individual, and I've done both. I would rather, you know, feel like I had some control of the finished product. But I don't have to always be that. There are times when I get hired for a writing job, and I try to make it clear in the outset, you know, am I the block? Am I the quarterback, or am I the blocker of this? Am I supposed to figure everything out and everybody tries to follow my strategy? Or do I just, you know, do my best to block and let somebody else's strategy happen? You can be either one, but, you know, I always tell, you can only carry football analogies so far, but I tell people I'm working with, look, I'll be the quarterback or I'll be the blocker. I'll be either one, but don't make me the blocker, then throw me the ball later and ask me to figure out where to go with it.
Well, how closely did they get, how closely did they stick to your script on Superman the Animated Series? We've got two episodes, Tools of the Trade.
Yeah, I think I wrote three of them and they only two.
Okay, and Father's Day with Steve Gerber, featuring Darkseid, the villain Darkseid. Did they stick to the script that you wrote? I mean, was it pretty much filmed?
Fairly much. I think they did some really clever trimming. What happens an awful lot of times when you have a freelancer write a script is they almost always come in long. Even the people who work on the show day to day frequently come in long, but the freelancers come in longer because it takes a few episodes to figure out exactly how many pages to write and to what to put on them to bring this thing in with some any sort of proper density of information. So I believe my script was like 5 minutes long, and Paul Dini or Alan Burnett or someone over there very cleverly figured out how to cut it without ruining it.
Oh, hey, you mentioned Garfield. It's what you're doing now. How can fans find out more about Garfield, and what's your role on the show?
Well, I am the supervising producer, which I guess means I supervise the producer. Basically, I'm the head writer. I write lots of them. I supervise the other people who are writing them and you know, do rewrites when necessary. I cast the show and I direct the voices. And that's what I do. If people want to see the show, it's on Boomerang every 20 minutes or something. I think they run, like 6 half-hours of it a day. Something like
wow.
that.
There's plenty of it because it was the Garfield show, and then was it Garfield and Friends before that?
Yeah, what happened was I originally did Garfield and Friends starting in the mid-80s. I did that for, depending on how you count, 7 seasons or 8 seasons. It's a little tricky. It's complicated. We produced 8 seasons, but they aired them as if there were 7. They aired them all, but they grouped them so like 7. And it was the number one show on Saturday morning when we stopped it because the economics were changing and the show was getting too expensive. So they just syndicated those for a while. And I did other things. And then a few years ago, different company had the rights to Garfield. And they came, Jim Davis said, I'll let you produce Garfield shows if you hire Mark Evanier to be the showrunner. And they came to me and said, will you be the showrunner? And I said, sure. And we've done 5 seasons of that. The fifth season is just being finished. The fourth season has never run in the United States. It's run in every other country, but it hasn't run in the U.S. For some reason.
Can we expect to see it?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Here's my answer.
You're just the hired hand on it, right?
Here's my answer when people ask me this. The actors are always calling, and people, fans are saying, when do we get to see the fourth season? And I say, quote, I'm only the supervising producer. How the hell should I know? Nobody tells me this, and I suspect I will find out they're airing because my TiVo will tell me someday. I'm amused by all this stuff. If you read my blog, you'll see that I am amused by how weird things are in show business.
Perfect segue. Look at you as the writer. The perfect segue into the blog.
Yeah, well, you know, the blog, I always have to plug the blog because it's the thing I make no money off.
We're plugging it right now. Look, if people want to find out more about Garfield, I'm sure it's season four. They're going to find out about on your blog, correct?
Well, I warn people not to go to the blog unless you got a lot of time because I got 20,000 posts on there.
Yeah, there's some great stories, though. And we talked about Cotter. There's some great Welcome Back Cotter stories.
I've had people disappear into my blog and never surface again because they start reading it, and they lose their jobs and their marriages. I'll be honest.
Full disclosure, yeah, but, I started getting sucked in.
Yeah, but the bottom line on it is that it's fun to write because nobody rewrites me, and I'm not doing it for money. I'm not doing it for anybody's editorial satisfaction. I'm just doing it to please myself and my friends, and that's the kind of writing that you love. So, the fact that there's no money in it is almost a bonus. And I won't take advertising. I won't let anybody else work on the software. I designed the whole blog myself. I said, I'm going to do it all myself. I let Sergio do different drawings for the masthead occasionally.
Great Sergio Aragonés, yeah.
Yes, my best friend in the male division.
Yes. Oh, amazing, too. And it's
my best friend with facial hair.
And if you want great stories of Battle of the Network Stars, they're on there.
Relive the
70s and all its Battle of the Network Stars glory.
Yeah, well, I just done a lot of weird things in my life, and I feel if you do weird things, you ought to share them with the world so that they're recorded somewhere.
It's great stuff.
I post a lot of obituaries on my site of people who would not get an obit anywhere if I didn't.
Well, we talked about Welcome Back, Cotter, the late Marcia Strassman. I mean,
there's
a nice little tribute there, and yeah, so many. Give us the website.
Oh, it's newsfromme.com. Or if you Google my last name, Evan Ear, you'll find it. I'm the easiest person to find on the internet.
You are, you're all over, and you're on Facebook?
I'm amazed. I go on blog, every so often I go on a website, and somebody says, can anybody tell me how to reach Mark Evan Ear? How can you not reach me? If you go to Google and type in Evan Ear, it shows you 15 places.
Here's my email, here's this, here's my house, come on.
When I was a kid, I was a little bothered by the fact that I had a weird last name that nobody else had. It's a made up name. It was once a Jewish heritage from Hungary name, and it got changed and mauled into Evan Ear. And I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have a name like Jones or Johnson that people could actually pronounce? And when the internet came along, it became a boon. Because I've got friends I got a friend named Jim George. He cannot find himself on the internet. If he Googles Jim George, he finds 8,000 other Jim Georges.
Yeah.
But you type in Evan Ear, and everything's either me or my cousin.
It's and you're the one that talks about Battle of the Network Stars.
I'm the only Mark Evan Ear on the internet. So if you can learn to spell Evan Ear, you can find me.
It's newsfromme.com.
Newsfromme.com.
And you're on Facebook, so people can find you on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on,
we'll get those links up.
I'm on Etch-a-Sketches, Mr. Slides. I'm on Kenner Give a Show Projector. I'm everywhere,
It's been fun. Hey, Mark, speaking on behalf of the listeners to Comic Book Central, we've not only enjoyed your comic book stories over the years, so glad some of those folks making those television shows hire comic book writers. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But we thank you for bringing some of these characters to life, and we thank you for all these stories. And I thank you for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure.
We weren't kidding about that blog. It is extremely easy to get lost in Mark's tales of Tinseltown and beyond. You're definitely going to want to check out his site, newsfromme.com. That's news from M-E, Mark Evan Ear, it's pretty obvious, .com. You can also follow Mark on Twitter at Evan Ear, and reach out to Mark on Facebook at facebook.com/Evan Ear. Tell him Stuberman at Comic Book Central sent you, and be sure to tell him you enjoyed his interview on today's show. Now, one thing Mark and I talked about that I did not include on today's episode was his time in the world of Indiana Jones, our favorite archaeologist adventure. Mark wrote the mini digest for Dark Horse Comics titled Indiana Jones Adventures, Volume 2, Curse of the Invincible Ruby, and he wrote a story called Indiana Jones and the Temple of Yearning for a Dark Horse free comic book day giveaway. You can check out the rest of our conversation Monday, December 15th, over on the IndieCast.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who help bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndieCast.
That's right. It is another cool, classic Comic Book Central IndieCast crossover. Now, speaking of the IndieCast, host Ed Dalasta, Keith Voss, Rob McGee, many others, turn Mark's Temple of Yearning adventure into an IndieCast radio drama, done in the style of the radio dramas from the 30s and 40s. You're going to want to check that out as well. It is very, very cool. Talk about bringing a comic book to life. It's amazing. I'm going to put all those links up in the show notes at the Comic Book Central website, comicbookcentral.net, as well as links to Mark's blog and his social media sites. So be sure to check all of that stuff out. Now, if you enjoyed today's episode, you can check out all of my interviews on the Comic Book Central website, or better yet, subscribe to the show on iTunes. You're not going to miss out on any of the fun if you do that. And please take a minute to leave a rating and review in iTunes. Trying to get a few more there. So if you like what you're hearing, post a rating and review. Please tell me about it. Would love to hear from you. Don't forget to share the lair and follow Comic Book Central on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Thank you so much for everyone who's been liking and following and sharing the lair. Much appreciated. Drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Tell me what you think of the show, some of the guests, some of the interviews. You can also click the Signal Me tab on the website. And if you want to hear yourself on the show, be my guest. Record an MP3, send it along. I'll play that as well. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for today. I've got to fly. I'm headed to the Berg for Steel City Con. I'm going to do my best to record some cool content for you to listen to in the weeks ahead. Should be another great convention in my favorite city. My thanks to Mark Evanier for joining me on the show today. And more fun is on the way, because next week on Comic Book Central, it's back-to-back episodes on one of the craziest films of the 80s. Or should I say beak-to-beak episodes? I'm going to be discussing Marvel Comics' first feature film, Howard the Duck, with none other than both Howards. That's right, Ed Gale, who was in the Howard suit, and Chip Zion, who provided the voice of our feathered friend. Next week, I'm going to kick things off with Ed Gale, who got plucked from his home on Duck World, plopped down in Cleveland, Ohio, and then rocked on stage with Leah Thompson. That's the next episode, Ed Gale. Until then, have a stupendous week. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivations, 3.0 unported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Yes, friends, there are times in life when you reach a point of conflict with one of your fellow human beings. When this does happen, is yelling and screaming the answer?
No.
Is foul language or physical violence the answer?
No.
There is a new answer. So the next time one of your brothers or sisters is mean to you, I want you to take my advice. Let your arms dangle loose at your sides. Take a deep breath. Smile and say,
I've got all